This Pardes Life is an original podcast production from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, please visit www.elmad.pardes.org, elmad.pardes.org.
What could be more fun than a beautiful Friday night meal? What could be more inspiring than learning a beautiful Rashi on the Parsha? Well, for many people, this is absolutely wonderful. But in fact, for many, many Jews, this is very divisive. Torah study, halakha, things that for generations and generations brought Jews together, nowadays very, very often do the opposite. In this series, What Unites Also Divides, we're going to be speaking with Zvi Hirschfeld on halakha, Jewish law, Torah study, and Jewish peoplehood, and look how these traditional categories have broken down in the modern world, and how perhaps, with Zvi's help, they can be brought together again. Zvi, thank you very, very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. It's an honor to be asked.
Let's just go straight for the jugular. Let's just go straight to the hardest question, Zvi. Halakha, Jewish law, do we still all have to keep it? All of Jews, that I mean, of course.
Well, there actually is a secret list of 10 people who don't have to keep it, but I'm not allowed to reveal that list. Look, a lot of it depends. I think there are two issues here. One is the theological issue, and that is if one believes that Torah is commanded by God and that the rabbis were empowered with an oral tradition to interpret it as such, then one would conclude that, yes, the entire Jewish people are obligated to keep Jewish law. And there's another question separate from the theological, which is the practical. In other words, can the Jewish people maintain their identity, their uniqueness, their mission without the boundaries and without the rituals, without the connections that halakha bring? I would argue my own personal theology is, on the one hand, I think the Jewish people are bound by a covenant with God that includes Jewish law. At the same time, I can't deny the fact that some of the most important things of the Jewish people in the 20th century in particular, for example, Zionism, were not caused or generated by halakha. And some of the best Jews out there doing the most of the Jewish people are not living halachic lives. So I guess I would say my own personal answer is, in theory, I think all Jews are bound, but I can't point my finger at an individual Jew and say, I know what God has in store for you, and if you're not avoiding milk after meat, then you're not doing your job in this world.
Zvi, I might just be the bad Jew in the room, but occasionally I just wake up in the morning and don't feel like davening at all, certainly on a trip to keep kashrut. Is just not very pleasant or appropriate or easy. First of all, I'm interested in what those moments are for you. And if you do keep halakha in those moments, what is it? Why do you keep halakha in those moments?
Well, first off, from your question, implies you actually sometimes wake up in the morning and you want to daven, so I'm already jealous of you. That's a very rare feeling. Look, I think on the one hand, there is this issue of spiritual discipline. I'm also a meditator, have been for over a year, and I rarely feel like meditating. And so I do find that spiritual discipline is important no matter what the practice might be. But I think it's also this reality. What happens when we do these halachic practices and we feel they haven't changed us? What happens if I go to daven in the morning and I still lose my temper with my kids and I still get angry about traffic and I still get annoyed that my shirt has a stain on it? What happened to all the perspective and spiritual growth I was supposed to gain from halachic practice? I think I sort of see it as a type of continuity, and I try to look at the overall picture. Like many commitments, I try to see it in terms of, the sum I gain at the end as opposed to breaking it up in small pieces and do I like it right now or do I not like it right now. But I could also say that the aspiration is still to have it be meaningful each time, even though I know full well I'm not going to make it.
It's interesting. Heschel was once asked this question. So a student said to him, sometimes when I daven in the morning, I really do have a powerful spiritual experience. But he said, I lose it during the day. What should I do? And Heschel is rumored to have said, remember that you davened. Somehow draw upon that. Since we're talking a little bit personally, I'm very interested both in your past and in your future. You grew up in a home that was not strictly halachic. I'm interested in what drew you or brought you to the system, and also what dilemmas or challenges you might have in bringing up your children within the system.
Wow, you're going to have to keep me on track with both of those questions. I grew up in a home that would be described as liberal conservative. My parents sent my brother and I to Schechter, and my brother became a Baal Tshuva at the age of 12. And my mother agreed to make the house kosher, or at least do the best that she could. I'm not so sure the Stipler would have eaten there, a famous rabbi from Bnei Brak. But, in terms of the family, it made certain changes. What's interesting is my family accommodated my brother, and it certainly got me more interested. But there was also, it was terribly divisive. I still remember my brother, when he started to keep Shabbat, being lectured by my parents about what a unpleasant effect this is having on family life, that we can't all go out to dinner together at certain times, or he was so limited because of Shabbat observance. But I would say my brother was a factor in getting me to think about it. I went to an Orthodox high school, and that certainly gave me more role models and encouraged my interest. And I took these things on very slowly, but it wasn't all rose petals. I definitely saw how it separated me from friends that I had from childhood that weren't observant. Nobody else in my extended family was observant. And I saw the downsides of how, for the people who aren't keeping this lifestyle, what a burden it was for them to accommodate my religious needs. In terms of my own children, it's very interesting, because you would think that because I grew up making decisions different from my parents, that I would be understanding and open-minded, and I found the opposite was true. I think for the first 15 to 20 years of my parenting, I was probably more rigid than most, and I was desperate that my children sort of follow a certain path. And slowly over time, I think I wore out, or something changed, and I really realized that this can't be forced. And I remember, I'll give you two examples. One time I was reminding my daughter about saying brachot, and she turned to me and she said, "Why can't you speak to me the way you speak to your Pardes students? Just, listen, be open-minded. You don't remind them every 3 seconds of every little detail." And I took that one to heart. That one sunk in. And then I have a son, my second son, who was in a phase where he wasn't terribly interested in davening, and I would try to nag him to daven and so on. And he pointed out, what is the point of davening? You can't force someone to pray. If they don't want to pray, what do I want him to do? Just stand there and say the words while I stand over him? So I realized the limitations of all that, and I think more importantly, how me being a constant judgmental, nagging voice in their lives in any area was just going to undermine my relationship with them. And I wanted halakha to be something positive in our home and not this voice of judgment and frustration and anger. So I'm in process.
Thank you very much. Thank you for sharing. I know for us in our home, a lot of the halakha is Jewish technology that we all use, technology that makes us Jewish. But I can see when I listen to you that that comes with a price, and the price is that, how much of the spirit, how much of the enthusiasm is one transmitting. We'll come back to the personal, because there are many, many more questions that I and I'm sure our listeners are interested in. But I'm interested now in asking you some more questions about the system more theoretically. And the first question is, the old story, how many Orthodox Jews does it take to change a light bulb? Change? So my question for you is, how flexible is the halachic system?
I think the halachic system is incredibly flexible. I don't think the challenge today is, can we find the sources or the justifications to make changes? I think there's a deeper debate, in my opinion, going on. One is very fundamental, and that it cuts to the heart of, what is the purpose of mitzvot? If one believes that the mitzvot are this secret, mystical access point to a world that we can't see, and even though we can't always understand or explain these rules, they have some deep, infinite, mystical meaning, and our job is to follow them, and it all works out in the end, then change almost sounds silly, because why would I want to change it? I have the mystical roadmap. I just need to implement it and stick with it. If, however, I believe that the halachic system is designed to implement or teach certain values or morals or behaviors, then the discussion really shifts, because then I have to always ask, is the system working? Is it actually making us better people? Is it making us more conscious of God, of humanity, of our moral and ethical responsibilities? When we hit that question, then I think we always have to ask, is the halachic system as it's currently constructed, is it doing its job? And I think the truth is today, we will be a lot more open, especially in the Orthodox world, to asking that question. If the trauma of 19th century Enlightenment and the challenge to traditional Jewish life had not caused Orthodoxy to become completely in self-protective mode, where every change is a slippery slope, every move is a concession to modernist forces that will simply erode the commitment to Jewish life. And I think that, we're still feeling the effects of that trauma, but I think in principle, there is no change that we couldn't consider as long as it was done with a deep sense of the ultimate values we're trying to pursue, a reverence for those who came before us, and an eye towards what we want to build towards the future. Whether we will do so or not, I think, is more of a sociological question rather than a theological one.
You mentioned basically two different justifications for keeping halakha. The first one is almost like a mystical one. It's like, using the word I used previously, it's some type of a technology that does the job. All we have to do is do that technology, use the technology, and things will be fine. And you said that approach is less open to change, or why would you change? Whereas the second one, which is when we try to create more human beings, which I'd say is a more existential, personal approach, I want to just push you on that and say maybe the opposite can be said. If one, and I'm interested to hear how you respond to it, if one thinks of it as technology, one has to make sure that the technology is the right technology before using for the current surroundings, and technology needs to change according to what we ask. Whereas the second one, where one is trying to create good human beings, perhaps there we could say it's tried and tested, it's always worked, it created the Stipler, it created Soloveitchik, it created these people, who are we to do it? And it's the secular world that is taking people away from it. I'm just making the counter argument to hear what you have to say about it.
Yeah, I hear the point, especially the second one, and that's sort of the issue of, it's worked in the past, why don't we just keep going? And I understand that, but the issue is, I think, this internal sense of really feeling divided, that our moral intuition tells us one thing and halakha tells us another. And there's a limit to that strain, to how often we can say, well, it's worked in the past, we're going to continue, if the continuing of it creates a terrible burden where we feel really disconnected from our own moral intuition and our own personal and even communal sense of what is good and right in the world. And that doesn't mean I think halakha is an important balance. I don't believe that we can always trust our intuition. I don't believe we can always know that whatever people of the 21st century say is good and right, that they've got it right. In the last 2,000 years, everybody got it wrong. But at the same time, there has to be room for that voice and for that moral intuition. And I think our tradition itself speaks to it, that there are many examples of, you know, vasita yashar v'tatov, doing what is good and right. And as Nachmanides points out, that one could be a very bad person with permission of the Torah. You could follow all the rules and still do all sorts of bad things and find the loophole. So I think the idea that we have a basic sense of goodness is extremely important, and to try to squash that would be to our own detriment. So I think we have to somehow figure out how to be respectful of the past, appreciative of the past, beholden to the people that came before, but still realize we still have to move forward.
What do you mean by somehow? Because I think here's the rub. I just want to expand a little on my question. I know when I taught halachic process, it was often very hard to give people answers as to why halacha doesn't change. It was clear that there's so much room for maneuvering and for change within the system. But you said somehow. And I'm interested in what that somehow is. What breaks you think there should be, could be, are on the halachic system?
So I'll give just a couple examples. I think the way we approach conversion today, many of the Jewish courts are still in this model of viewing converts with suspicion. Are they only here for ulterior motives? When I think today, most converts don't need to convert because it's going to improve their social position. They have a genuine desire to join the Jewish people. Or converts that are coming from a background where they have one Jewish parent and they've been raised Jewish their whole lives, they should not be treated like a Swedish backpacker who shows up at the Kotel and suddenly decides that Judaism is for them. So I think conversion is one area. The area of get and helping Jewish women receive a divorce when they want a divorce. I think there are numerous areas that halakha can adapt and can move forward and can, especially when we feel that moral and ethical push, that things should change. Are these things a slippery slope? I couldn't tell you. I sometimes think the risk of not doing them might actually be greater than the potential slippery slope, because I see, at least here in Israel, a growing number of young Jews, particularly in the, let's call them the national religious camp, who find themselves quite removed from halachic thinking and from Talmudic thinking because they don't see it as relevant to the modern lives that they are leading. And the more we proceed with viewing halakha in this very narrow, technical way, the more I think younger people who want something broader and wider and it speaks to them as modern people, the more they're going to disappear.
Look, I live perhaps more than you do on the edges of this of the Orthodox community. And, you know, being involved in a lot of the more liberal or even non-Orthodox world. And one of the things I've found is that people who live in this world tend to be less makpid, less careful about keeping everyday mitzvot. And I know that there are many, many people who I'm friendly with who are part of this world who say that it's inevitable the moment one tries to make Judaism more relevant, the moment one gives up on your first argument that it's some type of a magical system that I've got to keep, that its irrelevance to the modern world is what makes it more powerful, that inevitably the moment you start saying women can get aliyot or homosexuals can be more respected within the community, that inevitably leads to people not davening mincha at home, as opposed to davening in a minyan. And I'm interested to hear what you have to think. I mean, this is, for me personally, this is one of my biggest difficulties that I personally struggle with, which is, you know, is this, you know, what price does one pay? And is it really true that it's I'm not going to give you the answer. I'm interested to hear what you have to say.
So I'll say, I think it goes back to this question of what we're trying to create. Statistically, Satmar Hasidim, right, the majority of their children stay religious more than any other group, which shows you with what you're saying. The stricter you are, the more ghettoized you live, the more hermetically sealed you are from the outside world, the greater likelihood you'll have children who daven mincha and learn daf yomi and keep strictly kosher and so on and so on. But at what price? In other words, we have to ask, what is our purpose as Jews for being here? Is it to simply create more Jews who will also follow these rules? Or are we trying to build something bigger that we think is part of a much bigger, broader plan that God has for the Jewish people and for humanity? And if it's the latter, then I think we do have to take risks and we do have to experiment. And I think we do have to open ourselves up to bringing in new ideas, new strategies, new ways of thinking, even though, yes, we might lose some people along the way. But in my mind, that choice is, for me, it's fairly obvious. I have not in my own life chosen to take the safest route, and I don't think we should as a Jewish people. I will also add that because living in Israel, I also think changes that ratio or that dynamic. I think when you're a minority culture, the fear of children, you know, if your kid goes off to college and stops being observant in America, it's quite possible they could intermarry, they could really disappear from the community. But here in Israel, I don't think the risks are the same. Our kids who leave religious life will just be secular Jews living in Israel, and I think, therefore, that might even change our whole notion. It might be that those who are most afraid of change are thinking in as a minority culture would think, and maybe we need to think as a majority culture.
It's interesting, you spoke about intermarriage, you spoke about losing very, very laden language in terms of what is who's included, who's not included. I want to go from a little different perspective. There are people who are listening to this who intermarried and who are very, very comfortable being intermarried. There are people who might be lost to the halachic world, but are very, very much very, very much part of the Jewish system. I'm interested. Up until now, we've almost had an intra-Orthodoxy discussion. I'm interested in another question. If one of these fine people listening to us were to say to you, Tzvi, I'm never going to keep halakha fully. I don't believe keeping an halakha fully. What meaning might it still have in my life? Halakha, I know, is a very central Jewish value. What meaning might it have to me as somebody who respects the system but doesn't necessarily want to keep it the way that you do?
So I would say they would have to then take a different approach, a more liberal approach that says, let me look at these different practices from two perspectives. First of all, what personal meaning can I derive from them? In other words, even if I don't feel obligated to put on tefillin, for example, phylacteries, is there still something in this ritual that could enrich my life, remind me of certain values, connect me to something that I find positive? I think they'd have to do that with a lot of Jewish practice. I think the wider question is communally. What Jewish practices do I think are important to connect me to the community that I'm a part of? And I think that in a way they have a tougher job, because whereas the Orthodox person can just simply say, well, if it's in the code of Jewish law, I'll do it. I think the liberal Jew has to say, I don't have that luxury of having someone determine for me what I observe. I'm going to have to look and think and explore and see what do I think is necessary. But I think I would challenge them to broaden it out, not just what do I find personally meaningful, but what elements do I think are also important in connecting me to a wider Jewish community.
We live in a world which consists of lots of different kinds of Jews. The people we're talking about now, for whom halakha is an interesting system that they may choose to dip into in a serious way, and other people who see halakha as being an obligatory system to create better people, and a third group of people perhaps who see halakha as being, you know, our magic signs for getting the divine creator to bring the world to the place that we want to. All three very legitimate systems as far as I'm concerned, but I'm interested in what happens when these come to bear upon each other. It's all very easy if one person is in Bnei Brak and another person is in North Tel Aviv, but what happens when these come to join together? And I know that for you, there have been some moments in your life where these have come to a head. And I'm interested in asking you about the Kotel, for example. How do you feel davening there, where it's clear that people with one type of a technology are the people who are in charge?
So I think the question I'll answer on two levels. First, in terms of diaspora Jewry, I'm not at all convinced that these different approaches are not going to devolve into completely separate Jewish communities. In other words, it's not clear to me what's going to hold all these different Jews in terms of a connection to one another, which I think is very sad, but very real. They're going to have their own synagogues, their own schools, their own communities, and I'm not sure what's going to connect them. When it comes to Israel, which I believe is really what's so special about it, is it is actually a physical and political holder for all different types of Jews who are forced to interact and share space with each other. As much as we don't like it and complain about it, I think there, someone with a Zionist perspective has to be committed to making sure the public space is shared in a way that respects everybody. So when you bring the example of the Kotel, I think it's quite problematic that a Zionist Jewish state, which would claim to be a home for the entire Jewish people, is run only according to about 10% of the Jewish people in terms of how they pray. I think that's a very big problem. I'm not a big fan of davening there for that reason, and I think that our public spaces should be inclusive of all the different ranges of Judaism that are out there if we want to be true to our claim that we are really a home for the entire Jewish people.
Speaking of sharing space, I know that obviously you're very involved with Pardes. You're also involved with Nesiyah. I'm interested in your Nesiyah experiences, if you've ever had issues when you have felt you're not in your own space, but in somebody else's space, and how that has influenced you. In other words, how do you, as an Orthodox and Orthoprax Jew, I assume, handle being in a space where you are not the one who is setting the rules?
So I can give you an example of that I think is instructive for me personally, or was instructive. There was a 16-year-old girl who had lost her father a few months before a winter retreat, and she needed a minyan to say Kaddish for her father. And she prays egalitarian, and I joined her minyan to make sure that she had a minyan. I don't regret it now. I didn't regret it then. I think I always had the attitude that if non-observant Jews were going to compromise the way they spent Shabbat, eating kosher food, and all the ways that they were accommodating sort of my need to feel comfortable at home, then I also have to, you know, accommodate them. And that doesn't mean just being tolerant. That means actively sacrificing things that I want or I believe in to make the space comfortable and usable for them. So it does create tensions, it creates conflicts, but for them too. And if I'm actually in relationship with them, I have to be open to all of that.
I think it's a very powerful idea that one doesn't always go to the halachically strongest denominator. Tzvi, this has really been inspiring, I have to say to you. I knew it would be interesting, but I didn't realize how inspirational I would feel it. Let's bring it personal, but let's bring it back to Pardes. If you had a magic wand and could change Pardes in some way to be more in tune with these ideas, or even more in tune, I should say, with these ideas, what's one thing you might want to change at Pardes?
Well, let's see. I have to wonder who's going to be listening in on this one, right?
Now they've stopped listening.
Pardes still holds on to certain vestiges of an Orthodox institution that I don't think are helpful. And I'll give you two examples. Number one, the fact that the Mechitza Minyan is seen as the normative minyan of the Beit Midrash, and I think that that is very problematic and sends a very problematic message. I also think these issues of Jewish status, where we ask faculty to lead Birkat HaMazon, because what happens if a student is converted this way, another student doesn't recognize it? I personally think that's something the students should discuss and decide for themselves. How do we want to handle this in our community? How do we want to handle the fact that issues such as Jewish status and conversion divide us, yet we still want to be in community together? I think by going to the strongest halachic denominator, as you put it, I think we are avoiding a conversation that we need to have if we're really serious about this idea that we want to be a Beit Midrash that truly includes everyone. We at least need to have that conversation.
And speaking of that conversation, you've given us the beautiful segue to next week's discussion, which is where we're going to be looking at Torah study. Does it work? Why should we do it? Who gave the Torah? Academic versus traditional ways of studying, and many, many other issues. So tune in for that. Thank you very, very much, Tzvi, and may you continue to have many, many years of halachic observance, halachic struggle, and carry on being an inspiration to us all.
This Pardes Life is an original podcast production from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, please visit www.elmad.pardes.org, elmad.pardes.org.